her lips quickly to Felicia's forehead. As she rises, she braces herself with a shovel. She can't feel her legs, and everything about the moment suddenly feels wrong. She opens her mouth, all the parts of her that are a mother clawing at her throat, begging her to change her mind. But she can't. There is no other plan. This is all she has. Go, Mila orders. Quickly. Felicia turns to face the train, looks over her shoulder, and Mila nods again. Now, Mila whispers. As Felicia runs, Mila tries to resume her digging, but she's paralyzed from the neck down, and all she can manage is to watch, breathless, as the scene she's orchestrated transpires in slow motion before her. For a few interminable seconds, no one seems to notice the small body darting across the meadow. Felicia is a third of the way to the train when one of the Ukrainians finally spots her and points. The others look up. One of them shouts an order Mila can't understand and lifts his rifle. Suddenly, every pair of eyes in the meadow is locked on her daughter's small frame, watching as she runs, knees high, arms wide, appearing discombobulated, as if at any moment she might fall.
Mamushu!
Felicia's scream cuts through the thin air, shrill, sharp, desperate. Despite the fact that she was expecting this, it severs Mila's heart to hear her daughter call the blonde woman mother. Her eyes leap between Felicia, the German, and the Ukrainian with his rifle raised, awaiting approval.
Mamo! Mamo!
Felicia bawls between breaths, over and over again as she nears the tracks. The German watches Felicia, shaking his head, seemingly confused. The young woman looks at Felicia and then behind her. She too is confused. The Ukrainians on the perimeter swivel their heads and scan the meadow, trying to decipher from where the child has come.
Don't any of you dare point, Mila silently commands, grateful that she hadn't yet begun to dig a second hole for Felicia. No one moves.
After a few more slow seconds, Felicia reaches the train, and her cries dissipate as she flings her arms around the legs of the pretty blonde, burrowing her face into her overcoat. Mila knows she should return to her shoveling, but she can't help but stare as the young woman peers down at the feather of a child clinging to her thighs. When the woman looks up, she glances toward the meadow in Mila's direction.
Please, 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 Mila Mouse, take her, pick her up, please.
Another second passes, then two. Finally, the woman leans down and lifts Felicia to her hip. She says something inaudible and brings a hand to the back of Felicia's head, kisses her cheek. The Ukrainians look at one another, then snap at the Jews watching to get back to work. Mila exhales, looks down, steadies herself.
It's okay. You can breathe now, she tells herself.
When she looks up, Felicia has wrapped her arms around the woman's neck and laid her head on her shoulder, her rib cage heaving still from the exertion of the run.
Garments off! Everything! Now!
The Jews look around, panic-stricken. Slowly, they set down their shovels and begin to untie their shoelaces, unbelt their trousers, unzip their skirts. Mila reaches for the top button of her blouse, her fingers shaking. A few of the others are already half-naked, shivering, their pallid skin stark against the brown earth at their feet.
Hurry up!
The Jews stand with their hands feebly trying to cover their nakedness as the Ukrainians stoop to pick up their clothing. Mila refuses to undress. She knows there are only seconds before someone notices her, forces her to strip. But the moment her shirt comes off, it will be over. Her daughter will see her mother shot before her eyes. She twists her wedding ring around her finger and for a brief moment allows herself the indulgence of remembering when Selim slipped the thick gold band over her knuckle, how full of hope they were. And then she blinks. Without hesitating, she bolts for the train, dashing along the pockmarked earth, tracing her daughter's steps. She moves as fast as her legs will carry her. Pyramids of freshly dug dirt, shadowy graves, uniformed soldiers, and white-fleshed bodies fade to a blur in her periphery as she runs, her eyes fixed not on her daughter, but on the only person who can help her, the German. At any moment, she realizes, a rifle will crack, a bullet will send her careening to the ground. With tunnel vision, she counts the passing seconds to stay calm. "Just make it to the train," she commands, the cold air searing her lungs, the exertion setting her calves ablaze. The young woman at the train, still holding Felicia, has turned so Felicia can't see Mila approaching. And then, somehow, miraculously, the 20 meters are behind her. Mila is at the train, unscathed, standing beside the German, panting, her legs shaking as she presses her wedding ring into the meat of his palm. "Very expensive," she says, trying to catch her breath, willing herself not to make eye contact with Felicia, who's turned at the sound of her voice. The captain eyes Mila, turns the gold ring over in his fingers, bites it. Mila can see now from the silver stripes on his shoulders that he is Hauptsturmführer. She wishes she had a curvier build, or ample lips, or something funny or flirtatious to say that might persuade him to spare her. But she doesn't. All she has is the ring. A rifle cracks. Mila's knees crumple, and she covers the back of her head instinctively with her hands. From a squat, she peers through her elbows. The shot, she realizes, was aimed not at her, but rather at someone in the meadow. This time, a woman. Like Mila, she had tried to run. Mila stands slowly and immediately looks to Felicia. The woman she'd called mother just moments before has covered Felicia's eyes with a free hand and is whispering something in her ear. And Mila's heart fills with gratitude. The Ukrainians at the perimeter shout as they swarm their latest victim, who disappears as one of the soldiers kicks her corpse into a hole.
"A damn commotion," the German says, slipping Mila's ring into his pocket. "Wait here," he huffs, leaving the women alone by the train. Mila, still breathing heavily, glances at the young blonde-haired woman. "Thank you," she whispers, and the woman nods. Felicia turns and locks eyes with Mila.
"Mamushu," she whispers,
a tear trickling down the curve of her nose.
Shh,
it's okay," Mila whispers. It's everything she can do not to reach for her daughter, to wrap her up in a hug. "I'm here now, love. It's okay." Felicia burrows again into the stranger's coat lapel. In the field, the soldiers continue to yell.
"Line up!"
they order. Their voices are cold, detached. As the Jews stand shivering beside their graves, the Hauptsturmführer commands the Ukrainians to form a line as well. "Come," Mila says, looping an arm around the woman's waist. They hurry toward the near-empty train car to join the others who have been spared. The moment they are out of view of the soldiers, Mila gathers Felicia up in her arms and holds her close, devouring her warmth, the smell of her hair, the touch of her cheek against her own. The group shuffles into the corner where they huddle together, their backs to the meadow. Outside, they can hear sobbing. Mila holds a palm to Felicia's ear, cradling her head to her chest in an attempt to block out the sound. Felicia pinches her eyes shut, but she's figured it out. She knows what is about to ensue. And at the sound of the first muffled crack, something in her 3-and-a-half-year-old mind realizes she'll never forget this day,
the smell of the cold, unforgiving earth, the way the ground had shaken beneath her when the man a row over had tried to run, the way his blood had spilled from the hole in his head like water from an overturned jug, the pain in her chest as she'd run like she'd never run before, toward a woman she'd never seen before. And now, the sound of shots being fired, one after another, over and over again. Chapter 31. Addie. Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, March 1942. Since he arrived in Brazil in August, Addie has found that the best way to avoid dwelling too much on the unknown, on the alternate universe he's left behind, is to keep moving. If he stays busy enough, he can see Rio for all that it is. He can appreciate the city's limestone and tree-lined mountains, offshoots of the Serra do Mar, that jut up from behind the beautiful coastline, the ever-present, enticing smell of fried, salted cod, the narrow, bustling cobblestone lanes of the Central, where colorful Portuguese colonial-era facades brush shoulders with modern, commercial high-rises, the purple jacaranda trees that bloom in what the calendar says is fall, but which is actually Brazil's spring. Adi and Alishka have spent nearly every weekend since they arrived exploring the streets of Ipanema, Leme, Copacabana, and Urca, following the noses to the various vendors selling everything from sweet corn pamoyas to spiced shrimp on skewers, savory refeição, and grilled queijo coalho. When they pass a samba club, Adi jots down the address in his notebook, and they return later that evening to drink caipirinhas on ice with the locals, whom they found to be quite friendly, and listen to music that feels fresh and alive and unlike anything they've ever heard before. On most nights, Alishka foots the bill. When Addie is on his own, his life is consumed by more practical concerns, like whether or not he can afford his next month's rent. It has taken almost 7 months for his work permit to finally clear. During those months, he'd struggled, eking out a living with odd jobs that paid under the table, first at a bookbindery and later at an advertising agency, where he was hired as a draftsman. The jobs paid poorly, but without a permit, there was little he could do but wait. He slept on the floor of his 25-square-meter studio in Copacabana, splayed out on a cotton rug, a gift he received after installing the electrical system in the home of a new friend, until he was finally able to save enough to buy a mattress. He bathed beneath the faucets of a public shower on Copacabana Beach until he could afford to pay his water bill. He discovered a lumberyard north of town that was willing to sell him scrap wood for next to nothing, and he was able to build a bed frame, a table, two chairs, and a set of shelves. At a flea market in São Cristóvão, he convinced a vendor to sell him a set of dishes and cutlery at a price he could afford. Last month, even though Alishka had been urging him to splurge on a proper churrascarian feast, he bought something more dear, something that would last. A Super 6 Crossley tube radio. He found it used. It was broken, and to Addie's delight, underpriced. It took him 20 minutes to dismantle it and figure out the issue. A simple one, really. Just a bit of charcoal built up on the resistor. An easy fix. He listens to the radio religiously. He listens to the news from Europe. And when the news grows too bleak, he spins the station selector until he finds classical music which soothes him. Just as he had on Ilha das Flores, Addie wakes early in Rio and begins his days with his morning exercises, which he performs on the rug beside his bed. Today it isn't yet 7, and he's already sweating. It's the end of summer in Rio, and the heat is intense, but he's grown to like it. As he lies on his back bicycling his legs, he can hear the grate of metal gates being lifted as the cafes and newsstands 3 stories below open up on Avenida Atlantica. A block east, a blazing sun on the rise over the Atlantic beats down on Copacabana's white sand beach. In a few hours, the crescent-shaped cove will be teeming with its usual Saturday crowd. Bronzed women stretched out in figure-hugging suits beneath red umbrellas, and men in short swim trunks playing endless games of soccer.
Eins, zwei, drei,
Addy counts, holding his hands behind his head as he twists his torso left to right, reaching elbows to knees. Alishka once asked him why he always counted in German.
With everything that's happening in Europe and all, she'd said, leaning over the bed to peer at him quizzically.
It was the closest they'd gotten to talking about the war. Addy didn't really have an explanation, except that when he imagined a drill sergeant prodding him to complete his exercises, he always pictured a block-jawed German. With his sit-ups complete, Addy stands and wraps his fingers around the wooden bar he's hung in the doorway, counts out 10 chin-ups, and then lets himself dangle, his body limp, enjoying the sensation of his spine elongating toward the floor. Satisfied, he showers quickly, then dresses in a pair of linen shorts, a white cotton V-neck t-shirt, canvas tennis shoes, and a straw Panama hat. He slides a pair of newly purchased wire-rimmed sunglasses into the V of his tee, then reaches for an envelope resting on his bed, tucks it into his back pocket, and leaves the apartment, locking the door behind him.
Bom dia!
Addy sings under the awning of his favorite open-air juice bar on Rua Santa Clara, his shirt already clinging to the sweat on his back. From behind the counter, Raul beams. Addy met Raul during a game of pickup soccer one day on the beach.
You're not from around here, are you?
Raul had chuckled when he caught a glimpse of Addy's pale chest. Later, when he discovered that Addy had never tasted a guava, he insisted on a visit the next day to his juice bar. Since then, Addy has made an effort to swing by the bar as often as he can. He can't get over all the different flavors on hand. Mango, papaya, pineapple, passion fruit. Rio tastes nothing like Paris.
Bom dia. Tudo bem?
Tudo bem, Addy replies.
He's become fluent in Portuguese.
Voce?
No complaints, friend. The sun is rising and it's hot as hell, which means it'll be a busy day. Let's see, Raul says to himself, looking around at the produce arranged across the counter in front of him.
Ah, today I have a special treat for you, just in. Açaí. Very good for you. A Brazilian specialty. Don't let the color scare you.
Addy and Raul make small talk as Raul prepares Addy's juice.
So where are you off to today? Raul asks.
Today I celebrate, Addy says triumphantly.
Raul squeezes the juice from an orange through his press, mixes it with a dark purple acai puree in Addy's cup.
See? What are you celebrating?
You know how my work permit finally arrived? Well, I found a job. A real job.
Raul's eyebrows jump. He raises the cup in his hands.
Felicitações.
Thanks. In 1 week, I start work in Minas Gerais. They want me to live there for a few months, so this weekend I say goodbye for now to you, my friend, and to Rio.
Addy had heard about the job in Brazil's interior several months ago. The project, called the Rio Dos, involved building a hospital for a small village. He'd applied right away for the position of lead electrical engineer, but when he met with the project managers, they shook their heads, claiming that without the proper paperwork, their hands were tied.
Perfect your Portuguese and come back when you've got the work permit, they said.
Last week, on the day his permit was cleared, Addy contacted the managers. They hired him on the spot.
We'll miss you in Copacabana, Raul offers, and then reaches behind him for a banana.
He tosses it to Addy.
On me, he winks.
Addy catches the banana and sets a coin on the counter. He tries a sip of his drink.
Ah, he says, licking the purple juice from his upper lip. Lovely.
A line has begun to form behind him.
You are a popular man, Addy adds, turning to go. I'll see you in a few months, amigo. Ciao, amigo,
Raul calls after him as he turns to leave. Addy slips the banana into his back pocket beside the envelope, and glances at his watch as he sets off down Rua Santa Clara. The day is his to explore until 3, when he's due to meet Eliska on Ipanema Beach for a swim. From there, they'll head to dinner at the home of a fellow expat they met a few weeks ago at a samba bar in Lapa. But first, he must mail his letter. His is a familiar face at the Copacabana post office. He stops by every Monday with an envelope addressed to his parents' home on Warszawska Street, and to inquire about whether anything's come for him. So far, the answer has been a consistent and sympathetic no. 2.5 years have gone by since he received news from Radom. As much as he tries not to dwell on this, his trips to the post office are a constant reminder. As the weeks and the months pass, the agony of wondering what has become of his family worsens. Some days it erases his appetite and fills his gut with a dull ache that lingers through the night. Other days, it wraps around his chest like a strand of steel wire, and he's sure that at any moment, the flesh will sever, shredding his heart into pieces. The headlines in the Rio Times only heighten his anxiety. 34,000 Jews killed outside Kiev, 5,000 dead in Byelorussia, and thousands more in Lithuania. These killings are massive, far bigger than any one pogrom, the numbers too wretched to fully conceive. If Addy thinks too hard about them, he will imagine his parents, his brothers and sisters, as part of the statistics. Brazil, too, is preparing for war. Vargas, who like Stalin flipped his loyalty to the Allies, has battled German U-boats off the South Atlantic coast, has sent supplies of iron and rubber to the United States, and in January began allowing the construction of U.S. air bases on its northern coasts. Brazil's involvement in the war is real, but Addy often marvels how he wouldn't know it in Rio. Just as in Paris in the days before the war, here there is life and music. The restaurants are full, the beach is packed, the samba clubs pulsing. Addy wishes sometimes that he could disconnect, as the locals seem to be able to do, to immerse himself in his surroundings and forget about the war completely, the intangible world of death and destruction that lies crumbling 9,000 kilometers away. But as quickly as the thought enters his consciousness, he chides himself, inundated with shame. How dare he stop paying attention? The day he disconnects, the day he lets go, is the day he resigns himself to a life without a family. To do so would mean writing them off as dead. And so, he stays busy. He distracts himself with his work and with Eliska, but he never forgets. Addy pulls his letter from his back pocket, traces his fingers over his old address in Radom, thinking of his mother. Rather than imagine the worst, he has taken to recreating his lost world in his mind. He thinks of how on Sundays, the cooks day off, Nehuma would prepare a family dinner, taking great care as she crumbled caraway seeds between her fingers over a hash of red cabbage and apples. He thinks of how, when he was little, she would lift him up every time they entered and left the apartment so he could run his fingers along the mezuzah that hung in the arch doorway to his building, how she would lean over his bed and kiss his forehead in the mornings to wake him, smelling faintly of lilacs from the cold cream she'd rubbed onto her cheeks the night before. Addy wonders if his mother's knees still bother her in the cold, if the weather has warmed enough yet for her to plant her crocuses in the iron basket on the balcony. If she still has a balcony. Where are you, mother? Where are you? It's quite possible, Addy realizes, that in the midst of war, his letters aren't reaching his mother. Or that they are reaching her, and it's her letters that aren't reaching him. Addy wishes he had a friend in a neutral country in Europe who could forward his correspondences. There is also the possibility, of course, that his letters are arriving at his old address, but the family is no longer there. It's unbearable, picturing his parents confined to a ghetto, or worse. He'd begun writing to his physician, to his old piano teacher, and to the superintendent of his parents' building, asking each to share some news, to pass his missives on if they happened to know the whereabouts of his parents and siblings. He hasn't heard back from anyone yet, but he refuses to stop writing. Putting words to paper, engaging in a form of conversation, seeing the word Radom scrawled across the face of an envelope, these are the things that keep him grounded. Addie pushes open the door to the Copacabana post office, breathing in its familiar scent of paper and ink.
Bom dia, Senor Kurtz,
his friend Gabriela calls from her usual perch behind the counter.
Good morning, Gabi, Addie replies.
He hands her his letter, already stamped. Gabriela shakes her head as she takes it. He no longer has to ask. Nothing today, she says. Addie nods in understanding.
Gabi, I'm moving to the interior for a few months next week, for a job. Is it possible to hold my mail, in case anything comes while I'm away?
Of course, Gabriela smiles kindly, in a way that tells him he's not the only one waiting for news from abroad. As he leaves the post office, Addie's heart is heavy, and he realizes it's not just the fate of his family that is weighing on him, but something else. Twice in the last week, Alishka has brought up the subject of a wedding. She's asked him to think about what kind of food they might serve, and later suggested they talk about a honeymoon. Both times, he's changed the subject, realizing it's impossible to contemplate a wedding with his family still missing. Addie lets his mind slip back in time to the beach in Dakar, where he and Alishka had clung to each other as fiercely as they did to the idea of a life of freedom. Their love swept along by a swift current of danger and uncertainty. Would they make it to Rio? Would they be sent back to Europe? Whatever happened, they told each other, they'd be together. Now, at long last, they are safe. There are no more fishermen to bribe, no more expired visas to agonize over, no more hour-long walks to a deserted beach to make love in privacy. But now, for the first time in their relationship, they argue. They argue about whom to include in their dinner plans. Alishka's friends are more fun, she says, his friends too intellectual.
No one wants to sit around talking about Nietzsche, she once groused.
They butt heads about unimportant things, like the fastest route to the market, and whether the espadrilles in the shop window are worth the splurge.
I think not, Addie will say, knowing that Alishka will inevitably show up to the next date wearing them.
They bicker over which station to tune to on the radio.
Forget the news, Addie, Alishka once said, exasperated. It's too depressing. Can we listen to some music?
Addie sighs. What he would give to spend an hour with his mother, to get her advice about the woman he plans to marry.
Talk to her, Nahuma would say. If you love her, you must be honest with her. No secrets.
But they had talked. They were honest with one another. They talked about how things felt different between them on South American soil. Once, they'd even discussed ending their engagement. But neither is willing to give up just yet. Addie is Alishka's anchor, and Alishka, Addie's threat to the world he left behind. In her eyes, he sees Europe. He sees a reminder of his old life. Walking instinctively toward the Teatro Municipal, Addie finds himself recalling Alishka's words from the week before, when he confided in her once again how anxious he felt about losing contact with his family.
You worry too much, she'd said. I hate it, Addie. I hate seeing the sadness in your eyes. We're free as birds here. Let's relax. Enjoy ourselves a bit.
Free as birds. But he cannot feel free when so much of him is missing. Chapter 32. Mila and Felicia. Radom, German-occupied Poland, April 1942. Since the massacre, which is what everyone began calling it when Mila, Felicia, and the four others were returned to the ghetto, the SS have unleashed a beast. Perhaps they realized what they were capable of, or were holding back before. They aren't holding back any longer. The violence at Vaova escalates by the day. There have been another four roundups in the weeks since Mila returned. In one case, the Jews were marched to the train station and herded into cattle cars. In another, they were simply brought to a perimeter wall and shot. There are no more lists, no more false promises of a life of freedom in Palestine or the States. Instead, there are raids. There are factories searched. There are Jews lined up and counted. The Germans are always counting. And every day, a Jew in hiding or without the proper work papers is killed. Some are even gunned down at random. Last week, as Mila and her friend Antonia returned from a day's work at the factory, a pair of SS soldiers strolled by on the street, casually unholstered their pistols, knelt down, and began shooting, as if in target practice. Mila ducked silently into an alleyway, giving thanks for the fact that Felicia wasn't with her. But Antonia panicked and ran straight into their path. Mila sank to her knees and prayed as the sound of several more gunshots ricocheted off the brick walls of the two-story apartments lining the street. When the stomp of German boots finally receded, she ventured out and found Antonia a few meters away, lying still, face down on the cobblestones, with a bullet hole between her shoulder blades. It could have been me, she thought, sickened by the reality that what little order had existed when the ghetto was first erected had long been lost. The Germans were killing now for sport. Any day, she knows, could be her last. Remember, walk only in your socks and play very quietly, Mila instructs. She glances at her watch. She mustn't be late. Panicked over what might happen should Felicia be discovered at the factory, Mila has begun leaving her behind in the flat to fend for herself while she's at work.
Please, Mamushu, can I come with you?
Felicia begs. She wants nothing of staying home alone. But Mila is adamant. I'm sorry, love. You're better off here, she reasons. I've told you, you're a big girl now, and you barely fit beneath my desk at the workshop.
I can be small, Felicia pleads.
Mila's eyes water. It's the same struggle every morning, and it's awful. Hearing the desperation in her daughter's voice, letting her down. But she mustn't relent. It's far too dangerous. It's not safe, Mila explains, and it won't be for long.
I've been thinking of a new way to get us out of here, both of us. We must be patient. It will take some time to prepare.
Will we be with Father?
Felicia asks. Mila blinks. It's the third time in the past week Felicia has asked about Selim. Mila can't fault her for it. When she'd been at her most despondent, she'd indulged in hours of telling Felicia about Selim, a way of fooling herself into thinking that by talking about him, he would come back, give her some answers, some advice on how to survive, how to keep Felicia safe. She told Felicia countless stories of her handsome doctor father, the way he'd push his glasses up his nose, the way the corners of his mouth had crinkled when Mila first told him that she'd become pregnant within months of marriage, as if the strength of their love needed a physical manifestation. And later, after Felicia was born, the way he would make her laugh by counting her toes, by blowing kisses into her belly, by playing endless games of peekaboo. Felicia can recite these stories, along with the details of his face, as if recalling them from her own memory. Mila has put so much hope into Selim's return. It is understandable that her daughter would assume that any plan for their safety would involve him. But the odds of her husband being alive have begun to feel impossibly small. And Mila knows that the longer she clings to this fantasy, the more dangerous it becomes. It's been 2 years of constant worry, constant fear of the worst. Mila has had enough. She can't do it any longer. She has to let him go. to take responsibility for herself and for Felicia. It will be less harrowing, she realizes, to mourn him than to worry incessantly about him. Until they are safe, she's decided, she must believe he is dead. It is the only way to keep her wits about her. But how can she tell this to Felicia? How can she explain to her almost 4-year-old daughter that she might never know her father? You need to prepare her, Nehuma has said over and over. You can't keep her hopes up. She'll resent you for it. Her mother is right, but Mila isn't ready yet for the conversation, for the heartbreak that will ensue. Instead, she will try a new tack. She will tell part of the truth. She reaches for Felicia's hands, holds them in hers. I want so badly to believe your father will come back to us, but I don't know where he is, love. Felicia shakes her head. Something happened to him? No, I don't know. But what I do know is that if he is well, wherever he is, he's thinking of you, of us. Mila manages a smile. Her voice is soft. We will try to find him, I promise. It will be a lot easier to ask around once we're outside the ghetto. But until then, we must think about what's best for us, you and me. Okay? Felicia looks at the floor. Mila sighs. She squats before Felicia, wraps her fingers gently around her upper arms, and waits for her to look up. When she does, there are tears in her eyes. I know it's awful being alone all day, Mila says quietly, but you have to know it is for the best. You are safe here. Out there. Mila looks to the door, shaking her head. Do you understand? Felicia nods. Mila glances again at her watch. She is late. She'll need to jog to the workshop. She reminds Felicia about the bread in the pantry, about walking in her socks, about the place in the cabinet, the secret spot where she's meant to hide and to stay perfectly still, like a statue, should anyone knock while Mila is at work. Goodbye, love, Mila says, kissing Felicia on the cheek. Goodbye, Felicia whispers. Outside, Mila locks the door to the flat and closes her eyes for a moment, praying as she does every morning that the Germans won't raid the flat while she's gone, that she will return in 9 hours to find her daughter right where she left her. Felicia frowns. Her mind buzzes. Her father is out there somewhere, she is sure of it. He will come back to them. Her mother may not believe it, but she does. She wonders for the 1,000th time what it will feel like to meet him, imagining him scooping her off her feet, magically easing her hunger, filling her up with happiness. Her mother had mentioned a way to get them out of the ghetto. Maybe this new idea of hers will lead them to her father. Felicia's shoulders sink as she remembers the 2 plans before it, the mattress, the list. Both were horrifying. With each, she had ended up back where she started, and worse off for it. Her mother speaks often of waiting, of being patient. She hates that word. It takes Mila several weeks to gather what she needs for her plan to work, a pair of gloves, an old blanket, scissors, 2 needles, several lengths of black thread, 2 buttons, a handful of fabric scraps, and a newspaper. What she takes from the factory, she tucks discreetly into her bra or under her waistband, keenly aware that the last worker who was searched and caught with a spool of thread in the pocket of his winter coat was murdered on the spot. Every night, from the flat's 2nd-story window, she presses her nose to the glass and runs her gaze along the brick apartments lining the ghetto perimeter, studying each of the 3 gates at the main entrance, on the corner of Vavova and Lubelska streets, a wide arch for vehicles flanked by 2 narrower openings for pedestrians. And every night it's the same. The German wives arrive just before 6, dressed in their sleek overcoats and felt caps. They stroll in through the vehicle gate, and congregate at the ghetto's cobblestone entrance, waiting for their husbands, the ghetto guards, to be relieved from duty. Some cradle infants in their arms, others clasp the hands of small children. While the women mingle, the 300 or so Jews returning from day labor camps outside the ghetto are herded back in through the two smaller pedestrian gates. At 6 o'clock sharp, the guards, along with their wives and children, disappear from beneath the arched vehicle entrance, and all three gates to the outside world are sealed shut, not to be reopened until morning. Mila checks the time. 10 minutes until 6. At the ghetto entrance, a little boy darts from his mother's side to wrap his arms around the leg of one of the guards. Which of these strangers, she wonders, lives in her parents' old home? Which of the wives bathes in her mother's porcelain bathtub? Which of the children practices scales on their beloved Steinway? The thought of a Nazi family making themselves comfortable at 14 Warszawska makes her sick. She watches as the ghetto gates swing closed. 6 o'clock on the dot. This time, Mila decides her plan will work. It has to. She and Felicia will escape, and they'll do it in plain daylight for all of the goddamn guards to see. It's after curfew and the ghetto is quiet. Mila and her mother stand at the small kitchen table, their supplies laid neatly in front of them. A single candle burns for light. Shame I left my patterns at the shop, Nahuma says quietly, as she cuts a page of newspaper into the shape of the body of an overcoat. You'll have to dress warmly, she adds. We have nothing for lining. Mila nods as she kneels to pin her mother's makeshift pattern to the blanket she spread across the floor, snipping the wool carefully along the edges of the paper. She and Nahuma trade the scissors back and forth, repeating the process for the coat's sleeves, lapels, collar, and pockets. And then, sitting on opposite sides of the table, they begin to sew. The hours slip away as the women work. Every so often they look up at one another, their eyes glassy, and smile. It's been a long time since they've sewn together, and it feels good. A distant reminder of the afternoons, long before Felicia was born, when they'd sit down to fix a hem or patch a seam. It was often during those afternoons at each other's side that their most meaningful conversations would unfold. At around 3 in the morning, Nahuma tiptoes to the pantry and pulls out a drawer to reveal a safe hidden underneath. She returns with 4 50-zloty notes. Here, she says, you will need it. Mila takes 2 of the notes and slides the remaining 2 across the table. You keep these, she says. I'll be fine. I'll be with Halina soon. Halina had left Radom 3 weeks earlier when Adam was assigned a job working for the railroad in Warsaw, mending tracks destroyed by the Luftwaffe before the city fell. Franka and her brother and parents had gone with her. Halina had written as soon as she was settled, urging Mila to come to Warsaw. We found a flat in the heart of the city, she wrote. This, Mila knew, meant they were living outside the ghetto walls as Aryans. I am working on getting our parents' positions at the arms factory in Pionki. For you, jobs in Warsaw are plentiful. Franka has a job nearby. We have everything you need here. Please, find the way to come. Nahuma slides the notes back across the table. Here we have work and our ration cards. You will be on your own for a while, she says, nodding toward the window. You will need this more than we will. Mother, it's the last... No, it's not. Nahuma taps her breastbone gently with her forefinger. Mila had nearly forgotten. The gold. 2 coins covered in ivory cotton. Her mother had camouflaged them as buttons. And there's the amethyst, Nahuma adds. If we need to, we'll use it. What was left of the silver had bought Adam his life. Everything else they'd sold or traded for extra food rations, blankets, and medicine. Thankfully, they hadn't yet been forced to part with Nahuma's purple stone. All right then. Mila tucks two bills into each side of the coat's collar before stitching it up. When she first devised her plan, Mila had petitioned her parents to flee to Warsaw with her, but they'd insisted it was too dangerous. "Go find your sister and Franka. Get Felicia to a safe place," they said. "We'll only get in your way." It was wrenching for Mila to admit it, but they were right. Her chances of a successful escape were greater without them. Her parents moved slowly now, and still carried the faint Yiddish accents of their childhoods. Posing as Aryan would be more difficult for them. Halina had mentioned in her letter a factory in Pyonki, a plan to transfer Saul and Nehuma there. In the meantime, they were still employed, and everyone knew that a job was the only thing that mattered in the ghetto. As a dull, silver light fills the room, Nehuma sets her needle down. Mila sweeps the leftover shreds of fabric from the table into her palm and hides them under the sink. Their work is complete. Mila wraps a scarf around her neck, a patchwork of SS uniform scraps, and then slides her arms into the sleeves of her new overcoat. Nehuma stands, running her fingers over the seams, feeling for loose threads on the buttonholes, eyeing the hem that hangs a centimeter off the floor. She smooths a lapel and tugs at a sleeve to make it lie perfectly flat. Finally, she takes a step back and nods. "Yes," she whispers. "This is good. This will work." She wipes a tear from the corner of her eye. "Thank you," Mila breathes, wrapping her arms around her mother, holding her close. The next day, Mila hurries home from the workshop at 5:30. She is dressing Felicia in the foyer when Nehuma returns from the cafeteria. "Where is father?" Mila asks, slipping a third shirt over Felicia's head. She worries when her parents are more than a few minutes late returning to the flat. "He was put on dishwashing duty today," Nehuma says. "Had to stay a few minutes to clean up. He'll be here." "Why do I need so many clothes, Mamushu?" Felicia asks, looking up at her mother, her eyes curious. "Because," Mila whispers, squatting so her face is level with her daughter's. She brushes a few fine strands of cinnamon hair behind Felicia's ear. "We're leaving tonight, Sherry." She'd purposely waited to share the details of her plan with Felicia. She herself was nervous enough about it, and she didn't want Felicia to be nervous too. A flash of excitement spreads across Felicia's face. "Leaving the ghetto?" "Tak," Mila smiles, and then her lips tighten. "But it's very important you do exactly as I say," she adds, even though she knows that Felicia will. Mila buttons a second pair of pants around her daughter's narrow waist, helps her into her winter coat, and pulls a pair of her socks over her hands as mittens. Finally, she tugs a small wool cap over Felicia's head, tucks the ends of her hair underneath it. Nehuma hands Mila a handkerchief lumpy with her day's ration of bread. Mila slides it down her shirt. "Thank you," she whispers. In the kitchen, she retrieves the ID Adam made for her from the drawer with the false bottom and tucks it into her purse. Returning to the foyer, she slips into her new coat, her scarf, her hat, her gloves. Finally, instead of securing her iron band around her sleeve as she normally would, she holds it between her teeth and forefingers and tears it at the seam. Felicia gasps. "Don't worry," Mila says. Even though she's too young to wear one, Felicia knows what happens to Jews in the ghetto if they're caught without their armbands. Mila holds the white strip of cotton to her arm so the blue Star of David faces out and lifts her elbow. Nehuma sews the ends back together with two small stitches and snips the thread without knotting it. As Mila adjusts the band, she hears her father in the stairwell. "There she is," Saul beams, arms outstretched, as he lumbers through the doorway. He bends to pick Felicia up and swings her around, kissing her on the cheek. "My goodness," he says, "you feel like an elephant with all of these clothes on." Felicia giggles. She adores her Jadek, loves it when he hugs her so tightly she can barely breathe, when he sings her the lullaby about the kitten with the blinking eyes, the one his mother sang for him when he was a boy, he told her once, when he swings her in circles until she's dizzy, and tosses her into the air and catches her so it feels like she's flying.
You won't need that, will you?
Saul asks as he sets Felicia down, his eyes suddenly serious, pointing at Mila's arm.
Just until I get to the gate, Mila says, swallowing. Right.
Of course, Saul nods. Mila looks at her watch. It's 5:45. We have to go.
Felicia, give your Batsia and Jadek a hug.
Felicia looks up, suddenly disappointed. She hadn't realized that her grandparents would be staying behind. Nehuma kneels, pulls Felicia to her chest.
Do vidzenia,
Felicia mumbles, kissing her grandmother's cheek. Nehuma closes her eyes for a long moment. As she stands, Saul bends down, and Felicia wraps her arms around his neck.
Do vidzenia, Jadku,
she says, her nose tucked into the hollow over his collarbone.
Goodbye, pumpkin, Saul whispers. I love you.
It is all Mila can do to keep from bawling. She throws her arms around her father and then her mother, clutching them to her, hoping, praying it is not the last time they will be together.
I love you, Miriam,
her mother whispers, calling her by her Hebrew name. God be with you. And with that, Mila and Felicia are gone. Mila scans the street for SS. With none in sight, she takes Felicia by the hand, and together they begin making their way toward the ghetto gates. They move quickly, the wind biting at their cheeks. It's nearly dark, and as they walk, their breath, translucent gray, evaporates into the night. When they are a block away from the gates and the guards are in sight, Mila opens her coat.
Come, she says quietly, pointing to her shoe. Stand here on my foot and grab hold of my leg.
Mila can feel Felicia's tiny frame push against her. Her arms wrap around her thigh.
Now hold on.
Felicia peers up and nods, eyes wide, as Mila closes her coat around her. They make their way more slowly now toward the gates, Mila doing her best to walk without a limp, despite the extra 11 kilos she's carrying on one leg. There are 15, maybe 20 guards stationed at each of the two pedestrian arches at the ghetto entrance, each with a rifle slung over his shoulder. Several of them count aloud as a throng of Jews shuffles in through the gates, blind with exhaustion from their day's work outside the ghetto.
Hurry up!
One of the guards yells, waving a baton over his head like a lasso. Mila cranes her neck, scanning the weary-eyed Jews moving past, as if she were there to greet one in particular, her husband maybe, or her father. No one seems to notice as she weaves her way slowly through the crowd, toward the ghetto gates. Soon, she's but a few meters from the large vehicle gate in the center, where, as she'd anticipated, a dozen or so German wives had begun to gather, bundled up in overcoats, their rosy-cheeked children in tow. Her leg aches from Felicia's added weight. She stops to check her watch. 6:07. Shivering, she contemplates for the 1,000th time the consequence of a failed escape.
Have I lost my mind? She wonders. Is this worth the risk?
And then her world goes dark, and she's back at the roundup, huddled in an empty train car, her arms wrapped around Felicia's head in a futile attempt to protect her from the atrocious scene, even though they both heard the gunshots, the thump of frail, naked corpses collapsing to the frozen earth just 20 meters from them. Mila's upper lip is damp with sweat.
You can do this, she whispers, shaking off her doubt. Just count, she thinks.
It's her father's technique, one he's used since she was a child.
On three, he'd say, and whatever the daunting challenge, pulling a tooth, yanking a splinter from under a fingernail, pouring peroxide over a bloodied knee, the counting somehow made it easier.
To her right, a horse and wagon carrying food from the Jewish council clatters through the vehicle entrance and halts as half a dozen SS search the carriage contents, shouting, the entranceway din suddenly swelling.
This is it, Mila realizes, the distraction she needs. On three.
Mila holds her breath and counts.
One. Two.
On three, she turns her back to the gates, opens her coat, and reaches down, touching Felicia's head. In a second, Felicia is by her side, holding her hand. Mila reaches up with her free hand and rips the white band off of her arm, feeling the electrifying pop-pop of Nehuma's two stitches giving way. She crumples the band into her fist and stuffs it quickly into her pocket.
No one saw, she tells herself. From this point on, you are a German housewife, here to meet one of the guards. You are a free person. Think like one. Act like one. Stay right by me, Mila orders coolly. Look straight ahead into the ghetto. Don't look behind you.
In her periphery, Mila can see that several of the German women to her left have found their husbands. They stand chatting in pairs, their arms folded over their chests to stay warm. She squeezes Felicia's hand.
Slowly, she whispers, and together they begin inching their way backward toward the gate,
moving as if in slow motion, so as to remain unnoticed. Mila tries to force some slack into the rope-type muscles of her neck and jaw, to imitate the easygoing expressions and mannerisms of the German women around her. But as they move closer to the gates, she's thrown off by the sensation of a body too close to hers. She turns just as a young wife, her head craned in the opposite direction, knocks into her from behind.
Entschuldigen Sie mich, the woman apologizes, adjusting her cap.
She smells of shampoo. Mila smiles, waves her free hand in the air.
Es ist nicht, she says quietly, shaking her head.
The woman peers at Mila through crystal blue eyes for a moment, glances down at Felicia, and then she's gone, lost in the crowd. Mila exhales and squeezes Felicia's hand once more. They continue on, shuffling backward toward the vehicle gate. More wives stroll in from behind them. They tilt their chins now and then in Mila's direction, but seem to look through her.
You are one of them, Mila reminds herself.
As long as they keep their backs to the entrance and move discreetly enough, she prays, they'll blend in.
Slowly now. Right foot? Left foot. Pause. Right foot? Left foot. Pause. Not so tight, she tells herself, loosening her grip on Felicia's sock-clad hand. Right, left. Right, left. Steady. Almost there.
The last of the Jews has made his way into the ghetto, and Mila watches from the corner of her eye as the pedestrian gates are closed and padlocked. When a body suddenly brushes by, bumping her elbow with something hard, she presses her lips together just in time to silence a yelp that nearly escapes her throat.
Move!
The guard yells, but marches by without stopping. Finally, Mila senses a structure overhead. They are beneath the main entrance, the arched vehicle gate. A gust of wind lashes at their backs, and Mila reaches for her hat to keep it from blowing away. She tugs its brim low over her brow and glances down at Felicia, who is white in the face, but whose expression is remarkably calm.
Stay focused, Mila reminds herself. You're so close. Count your steps. One. Two.
They creep backward.
Three. Four.
On her fifth step, Mila can see the outer wall of the entrance and the sign that reads, Danger of Contagious Diseases. Entry forbidden. She can hardly believe it. They've made it outside the ghetto walls. But these next few steps, she realizes, are the most important. This is the moment she'd replayed in her mind over and over again, like a scene out of a movie, until she convinced herself her plan could work. Summoning the last